We're back.
Again?
I'm waiting for the clock to switch over. There we go.
Yeah.
The clock
is switched over. There it is. Okay.
So I was running off at the mouth for the last session for servers. I could talk about storage spaces all day long because it's so cool. And you really could spend hours and hours debating how they work. One of the questions that came up I want to specifically address, this is the wrong section for it, but I got to address it, is the fact that someone was asking about storage spaces. Do you enable hardware level RAID on your controllers talking to your hard drives as well as storage spaces? You actually don't. They recommend you just leave pure exposed disk with caching capabilities if you have that on your RAID controllers and expose that to the operating system to make the storage space on top of it. You obviously also can't make a storage space if it's a boot partition or if it's a system partition.
Right.
It's only for data drives. But anyway, that was storage. So if
And that's also just, that's, you know, from what I understand, that's somewhat of a Rick opinion there because of that whole hour-long debate you had the last time that question came up.
Yeah. So So you would use your hardware-based RAID solutions for your protecting your system volume and boot volume. or you do iSCSI boot if you wanted to. And then your data volumes you use your storage spaces for. But we're not talking about storage right now.
No.
So this is the next module, and we're going to be talking about implementing networking services.
Fun stuff.
So there's some really interesting stuff in here as well. I'm also a networking guy, too, so this is another in my roundhouse kind of thing. Exchange.
Okay.
SharePoint.
Okay.
SQL.
Share.
Okay. I share well. I play well with others.
Let's add day three, Exchange and SharePoint, just for fun.
Nice. Yeah, so we're going to be focused on server technologies here. And flip to my slides here. We're going to be looking at the implementing networking services specifically. This is almost the end of the day for me to be able to take a bit of a break. Ed, take a bit of a break, too, for networking services. And specifically in this one here, what is new with DNS and DHCP is two really quick things that's in there. Quick hits, if you will. Then how to go in and talk about IP address management, another topic that I could
that
talk
Rick
about
will go
for
on
hours
and
hours
on
about.
And on.
Because it's important. Everyone has to deal with this bucket of junk that they have to deal with is how to handle their IP address management. So we've got a solution for you in Box, how that works. Then we're going to take a nap.
Yes, that's my favorite part of the afternoon.
And then we're going to wake up from the nap, and we're going to go ahead and talk about how to implement.
How to implement another nap.
Yeah. Now, again, because nap hasn't changed, it's still fundamentally you just put your head down and you rest for a while.
Yes.
It's a matter of how long you want to nap
for. I
want to
know if these 24...
No, yeah, that'll leave an imprint on the screen.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It brings a whole new meaning to the term face goo on your phone is what you're doing to that monitor right now. The nap itself basically has not changed from what you can do in Server 2012, so we're not going to be covering that much in depth. We're going to cover the new stuff instead for this one because this is upgrading your skills to 2012.
You just want to keep this entire session on IPAM. That's
if I could.
We're going to do the quick bang bang on one new thing in DNS, one new thing in DHCP,
yep.
Nothing new in nap.
And then go
and then
IPAM.
We should change the order.
You got it. Well, you know what? Let's pay some homage first to a couple new things with
all
DNS.
Right.
These are definitely some new things that are there. DNSSEC actually isn't new.
Didn't you do a session on that once?
I alluded to DNSSEC. I talked more about troubleshooting DNS, and
right.
I alluded to some of the things with DNSSEC. What I will say is that it was not exactly an easy solution to implement on Server 2008 R2. It supported it. You could definitely implement it. There's white papers about how to do it and that sort of stuff. The basic idea is that you want to have your communications going from your clients to your server and to the authorized server. Think of it inside inside of your environment with Active Directory, not being vulnerable to a man-in-the-middle attack or to poisoning or seeding DNS with the bad entries. And the way you do that is you use DNSSEC. So that's what this little example talks about. And I'll show you how easy it is to set up, because it's actually pretty easy, and then how to make sure that it's all set up and working, and then force it down to your clients to make sure they go off and they use it. The second thing that's also new with DNS, which is kind of interesting, is this thing called global name zones. And I got to do a shout-out to the MCT summit that I was at a little while ago. To C. Ron, I forget his last name. He's an MCT guy that does training. I don't even know where he's from.
I don't know.
I think he's from the East Coast
delirious.
Or something like that.
I had the flu.
Anyway, he actually sat there and got very passionate about describing what the heck these global name zones were for. And I'm like, yeah, whatever. It supports it. Who cares? It's there. He says, no, you don't understand. This is one of the major first steps you can do to put the final nail in the coffin to wins. Can you believe that? Global name zones, the whole purpose of what it does basically is like a flat namespace. Normally with DNS, you walk up the hierarchy to be able to see the tree to find out what the answer is. But if you're on a peer, so if I'm at europe.contoso.com and then I'm at northamerica.contoso.com and I want to be able to access DNS-wise, access an entry that's in Europe, I would have to know the fully qualified domain name because I can't walk up and walk back
down.
Right,
it doesn't like by default go up and down.
Not like Active Directory where I have a global catalog server I can go off and ask. So what you would use is basically either the fully qualified domain name or you would use a global names zone. You basically make it, it's called global names, capital G, capital N, mm-hmm. and you put in the flat namespace. As an example, Lisbon as the name of the server. MOC course, we're always using Lisbon
absolutely.
For some reason. In Europe, so
it was
Lisbon.
MCT that was telling you.
You
this,
got it.
So, yeah.
So you can actually just put in Lisbon in global names, and that DNS server will now be able to go in and resolve Lisbon, because Lisbon points to a CNAME that is actually the FQDN in the outside of the DNS walking path for recursive lookups that will resolve correctly to Lisbon. So Lisbon, if it changes its IP address to something different because of DNS, it's trackable because it's dynamic DNS. In Active Directory, you'll be able to update entries. Global names solves that problem for quickly referring to a name. The reason why that eliminates WINS is because WINS is flat namespace.
Yep.
And typically, if you're looking at being able to support, for instance, Exchange 2010 and down-level clients, you have to have just the flat name resolvable, and that's where WINS would still be used, potentially, as one example. Now global names can take care of that.
Yes. And make sure you remember it is global names.
Yes.
That's not a proper name. Global names
and it's
zone. Hard
the same way you make a forward lookup zone, that is actually a proper dotted notation for corp.microsoft.com or whatever it is. Same thing, except that it is simply a flat namespace. Global
names. And it's not new. It's exactly the same as it was in Server 2008, but it's not something that was heavily
called
understood or utilized.
Yeah, I'd say called out almost, right?
Yeah.
So DNSSEC, that's the first thing that's actually the bigger change for what's going on with DNS. It's simpler to deploy, and it's a lot easier to deploy than a version 2000. And I will fess up. I have not actually deployed it in 2008 R2 because I've been working and focused on Server 2012 for
so
long.
That makes two of us.
And so I can understand your pain if you've tried to deploy this with Server 2008 R2 inside your environment. To deploy it, basically, you go in, you assign the DNS role to a server, which you already have, and then you choose the zone in question that you want to sign. And this is going to be your internal zone that you're going to be signing. You then identify trust anchor points, which basically is who are the guys that are authorized to answer these questions that need to be able to share off and have access to this information. And then you also have to update your own local client configurations with the NRPT table, which is the NRPT table, which basically identifies name resolution policy table, which allows clients to determine, if I'm looking for Contoso, corp.contoso.com, I'm not going to go to the public internet to try to resolve it. It's going to use my internal server name resources to be able to go off and define it. So basically, those are the major steps you got to go off and define and to be able to use. So let me just quickly show you how easy it is to set this guy up. And you can, is there any questions so far in the queue while I'm getting this ready to go here? Nothing quickly, because I caught you off guard.
Nothing that is quick, and no, you had me so just
enthralled
with you that...
Nice.
Give me your hat.
No. You don't deserve the hat. Okay. So I'm here on my DNS server, which is my domain controller. So if I just go over here and click on DNS, I can go off and take a look at it. I have one DNS server inside my environment. Right mouse click and choose DNS manager. Pretty simple stuff so far to manage DNS. Now, I want to go off and use the FQDN reference. I think it's actually a release candidate bug for why both of them are showing up there, because I didn't actually notice that in RTM.
No.
Anyway. Work on this one. That's the one you want. And I want to go in here and choose the zone in question I want to protect, which is the adatum.com internal zone. Right mouse click on it, and then basically choose DNSSEC, sign the zone. If you choose the other one, it actually is grayed out. You don't have the option to do this. And this is going to basically kick off the wizard for being able to go off and to use the configuration of this. Read about it for what it does, how it works, DNS protocol, industry standard, yada, yada, links to be able to go off and talk about DNSSEC. And then I can go in here and choose how I want to go off and sign my environment. And so here, in this case, I'm actually going to just be taking the default settings. I'm going to say sign the zone with a new set of zone signing parameters because I've never set this up before. I want to be able to use that particular server as the key master, which is the main top-level guy. I want to go off and basically say the key signing key that's going to be up and using is a private key. It's going to be stored. There we go. Go off and use it. I'm going to go off and have an algorithm that's going to be used. I can configure a different algorithm if I wanted to. I'm just going to go off and add in one here. I want to generate new signed keys because this is the brand new first time I've set this up. Again, I could pre-generate these keys if I have an external third-party utility or something like that I want to go off and use. It tells me my algorithm I want to use to be able to protect and sign this private key and this public key. I'm taking the defaults just to be able to make this work. And then I'm going to say, okay, The zone signing keys, that was basically for the server. Now for the zone, same thing. I'm taking the defaults for the same options for being able to go off it. And the neat thing is, this is actually going to go in and cycle the key every 90 days, again, in case that key gets compromised for some reason. Hit OK, hit Next, take the defaults, and then choose the authentication for authenticated denial of existence settings. I'm just going to say go ahead again, use the defaults. And I'm going to say enable automatic update of trust anchors on the key rollover, and also go ahead and enable the automatic distribution. So basically, if this is a domain controller, trust anchors for the zone will be distributed to all other DNS servers on domain controllers. So this just simply makes sense. Instead of your clients having to go back to this one guy to say, is this key accurate? Now they'll be able to go through the regular distributed model for DNS to be able to say, hey, is this key accurate? Is it good? And it just handles it, so that's what I want.
You know, Rick, let me throw in real quick, and I know that we've already answered it in the Q&A, but a lot of talk about keys here. Do we need a CA server? Do we need a certification authority?
In this case, we're not going to be using a CA server for this. This is simply going to go off and sign it and then generate the appropriate public and private keys for locking of this up, because this is all internal, and I can
it's
get
internal
access
to
this.
DNS. Yeah, okay, so... It's a big question I get all the time.
You got it. Configure the values for DNSSEC signing and policies. Basically, how long is it good for? When can it need to be refreshed? Everything else. And then hit next to basically say finish. This literally is one of those typical next finished implementations.
There's no I agree somewhere in there?
No, I agree. This isn't a EULA. The zone has been set up successfully. Hit finish to close that individual wizard. That guy now is signed, basically. Taking a look at DNSSEC, I can now go in and say properties of it to be able to view all the properties that I chose and be able to make any changes if I needed to. That basically sets up my DNS servers for that particular zone and sets it all up. The clients don't know about this yet to be able to use DNSSEC and support it. So I actually have to go in and configure the clients. Easiest way to do this? Group policy. Use group policy. So go in here and let's start up group policy management. Go off under, in this case, I'm going to say domains and use the default domain policy for the main default domain policy that I'm going to be modifying in this case. I want to say go ahead and say edit for the default domain group policy. And then under the editor, under computer configuration, because it's the computer that basically does this, under policies, Windows settings, security. When this guy opens up, security settings. Under security, I can then go in and take a look at my... Windows settings, name resolution policy table. Name resolution policy table.
Now you talk about a lot of this with group policy. Do we need to have, does this have to be on an AD DNS server?
If you don't, you then have to go in and basically run this on individual servers to make multiple trust points to be able to have more than one central point of failure possibly to be able to do this. So where am I? I'm in Windows settings. I go to name resolution policy folder.
You see what I did there? Intentionally, whatever I could to make you mess up on your demo.
You totally just messed up on my demo to see where is my NRPT utility. Oh, right there. Name resolution policy. Down here, for DNSSEC, basically I say enable DNSSEC. It literally is just one checkbox to be able to say it. In the rule checkbox, I want to say go off and create a new rule, which is up here for suffix-wise. Go in and say... adatum.com is the internal DNS name I want to do it. Be able to go off and use it. And anything settings I'm missing here? Nope. DNSSEC tab, enable DNSSEC for the rule checkbox, which is turned on. And basically, this is it. Scroll down because the window is too big. Hit apply. Create that rule. There it is set up. Hit apply. That guy's now set. And at the next default policy refresh interval, it will now go in and update my computers to say, go ahead and use this particular DNSSEC rule, NRPT stuff for this particular guy. Go off and talk to your domain controllers to be able to go off and find them. Pretty simple. DNS manager. I guess in theory, I could go back and take a look at my DNS manager and just kind of show you that I now have what's known as trust points. And my trust points, if I browse down a little bit here, will show me that Adatum is going to be using my... in this case, the keys that are being used, and also where they're going to be stored. So they have access for the Adatum location. They're all set. And that is DNSSEC setup.
You know, real quick, what about down-level clients? How does DNSSEC going to work if you have, let's say, XP client laying around?
XP client? You're hitting me with a question I actually don't know the answer to,
okay.
My friend.
Okay. I don't either, which is why I asked you. Yeah. It came across here.
I'll have to say, let's get back to that one.
Okay.
Because
I jotted it down. So.
Okay. We'll have to get back to that okay. one. I'm pretty sure it's a no-go because it's for modern-based clients, what you're going to be doing with it for.
That's the answer.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to say it is because I don't know for certain if it
no,
is.
No, but that's okay.
Next up is DHCP. What is new with DHCP? What is DHCP?
The Dynamic Host Configuration Protocol.
And what does it do?
It dynamically gives hosts their IP configuration.
Well, you sound like a textbook, my friend. What happens if DHCP goes belly up?
Then you go ahead and spin up another DHCP. Right? Isn't that the answer I gave you yesterday?
No, it results in the loss of connectivity
yes,
for your clients.
Absolutely.
So
it
basically
does.
You don't know what servers happen to have addresses, what machines have addresses, what client systems, what surface devices, what laptops, what phones, what other devices happen to have them. You don't know which one's doing what. So basically, you don't want to have the issue of running out of your DHCP server address scopes.
Well, isn't that what DHCP failover is for?
Well, that's what I'm getting to, is with the new thing with Server 2012 is it has DHCP failover built into it as one option. This is different than the previous way of doing this, where you would basically make a highly available DHCP service on a cluster. Or you would make a split scope where you have 80-20 rule
yeah.
and have two scopes being able to do
Wait,
stuff. And
you mean no more 80-20 needed?
You don't have to worry about doing 80-20. You can still do it if you want.
Okay.
You don't have to worry about doing 80-20.
All right.
It's actually using an industry standard protocol for how it's going to be exchanging data back and forth to make this failover work. It's really, really cool. The other thing that's new with DHCP that you need to be aware of is DHCP name protection. If a non-Microsoft system boots up and happens to receive its address from DHCP, and DHCP is set to automatically enroll people in DNS that can't enroll themselves,
mm-hmm.
which is an option to mm-hmm. be able to be located, and they happen to call their tablet of choice Rick's computer, even though I already have Rick's computer.
My phone.
Or your phone, or whatever yeah. it happens to be. You can end up with a name conflict, which can cause weird things to happen inside your environment. So basically, there is a way you can turn on in DHCP Manager the ability to go in and say, hang on a second. Check DNS first to see if that name's already been registered by a Windows-based machine. And if so, quash that request and grant them the address, but don't let them register the name.
Right. And that was a question
That's different than IP conflict. That's simply the name conflict.
Right. No, this is strictly the names.
So those are the two major things that happen with DHCP. And in fact, let's talk a little bit about DHCP failover, what it is. Basically, you have to set up a failover relationship, and the failover relationship is based on an FQDN, fully qualified domain name, has to be another Server 2012 box that's running DHCP, and you do not need to have any scope set up on the other side. So no 80-20 rule, that does not apply. The MCLT, the table, basically determines when a failover partner needs to take control of the subnet or scope. So basically, there's a background process going on that keeps that scope up to date between those two different systems. And then when there's a heartbeat of a certain period of time that particular server has not talked to its partner, that's the failover partner, it will say, not working. So the failover partner will basically take over the environment and start to dish out addresses and be able to renew addresses. Mm-hmm. And it's actually going to try to keep the addresses as they are, because people are going to try to renew at the half-life and at the half-half-life and stuff like that, as they always do.
Right.
It's going to try to keep those alive as long as it can, and then finally it's going to say, you know what, I can't do this anymore. I'm going to give you a brand new address from the scope, and that's when it starts to give it. Because what can happen is that first guy can come back online again.
Right.
If the first guy comes back online again, you got to get the data back over to him, so there's a period of emergence and convergence that has to happen that's in there. So basically, be aware that you set this up, there's a failover period, after so many heartbeats it takes over, it doesn't take by automatically. You can also set up in load sharing mode, where basically it just goes in and does a much more real-time solution, and they both give out addresses and share back and stuff back and forth with them. But basically, you can set up the message back and forth between those two servers. They have to authenticate for, again, another layer of security. And the good thing is firewall rules that communicate between these two systems are going to be set up correctly to be able to do replication between them. It sounds a heck of a lot more complex than it is to set up. So let me show you how to set it up.
Please do, because I'll tell you, I've been... I don't know about you, but I've had people asking me for well over a decade, you know, how to set up and why we can't set up true DHCP failover. So this is again something I love it. I mean, I love the list of things in Windows Server 2012 that it's like we've been asking for it, and they've all get answered in this one version. It's great.
Okay. I think I'll have my screen over here. This is my, you can see at the top there, my SVR1 box. This is not my domain controller. He's up and running. He has a DHCP server scope, or sorry, DHCP role installed. If I go in and launch my DHCP manager on this guy, he's currently set up in such a way that he does not have any scopes. They literally are a blank install, and that's it. Nothing else there. Nice and simple. Mm-hmm. Okay, so remember that. We'll come back to that in just a second.
Let me go write
back
it down over, so I can remember that.
You come back over here to my domain controller where my DHCP server is. Minimize this guy out of the way. Get that guy out of the way. I don't need him anymore. DHCP. Right mouse click on him and do DHCP manager. Now in here, what I'm going to do is very simply, on the DHCP manager console, it's on a per scope basis. Obviously, in case you don't know, you don't need to worry about doing this in IPv6. There's other ways of doing this in IPv6. This is for IPv4. And I've got one scope. I simply right mouse click on here, and I say configure failover. And it says, okay, are you sure you want to do this? It enables high availability. Wizard will guide you to the setup process. Select from the following list of scopes you can use. I only have one scope to be able to do it, because I can say select all. You don't have to do all of these guys. I'm just doing one. What is the name of the host name of the IP address of the partner server? And in this case, because I'm lazy, I'm just going to type in 172.16.0.21. I'm going to say add that server.
Why is that? Because you're lazy.
Well, because I can.
Okay.
I could also just hit the choose server and then choose from the list. So, you know what? I'll be even more lazy and choose this guy to go that way. Now I'll come back after a little bit of a timeout with a request because you know why? That guy's actually showing up at a different IP address range. That's his other network card that's showing up in DNS. So here he is. That's the guy I want to configure it with. Lead time, basically, is how long are you going to be able to wait before you have to worry about kicking in for that individual server. I'm going to be doing a hot standby, and the standby is basically going to say reserve a certain number of addresses specifically for the standby server. I can say when that interval switch is going to take place. In other words, the time frame from not hearing from someone on the other side is going to say let's change this to like 10 minutes if I wanted to. And then the shared secret between the two different systems, I'm just going to go in here and choose my lovely shared password. This is not the administrator password. This is simply me choosing a password that I'm going to use on the other side, and that's it. And say next. Say finish. It goes off. Successfully completed everything. Hit close. And then that guy now is set up for my failover capabilities. If I take a look at my failover tab from the properties, I can now see who it's set up the failover to and what the settings and parameters are. Notice I can't actually make any changes here. I'd have to cancel the failover, basically turn that off, and then make it come back up again. If I go back and take a look at my other server, which is server number one, and bring this guy up with a refresh, IPv4, refresh, there we go. There is my new scope, and he's sitting there waiting for things to take place. He has the address pool allocated. He sees what leases are currently allocated because it's a demo environment. No one's using DHCP. but he's sitting there waiting in live with his addresses. And he's going to wait for not hearing from his partner in this crime for 15 minutes before he kicks in and starts to actually dole stuff out. You can set this up so that you can have failover from one guy to the other guy. Now, obviously, from an architectural perspective, the first server, which is the domain controller, has to be able to get packets to the other side, just be routable. Mm-hmm. And likewise, that second server I'm doing a failover to has to be able to route packets back down to that first guy. So either you're going to be using DHCP relay agents to be able to pass the broadcasts, or you're going to be using multi-homed servers that have connections to different servers.
All right. Now, with this failover, it's the scope that's being... that's really being redundant, correct?
Yes, this isn't a highly available DHCP server.
Right.
You can still do that if you want. That's additional steps with doing a cluster. But this is simply, I need to make sure that my scope is covered, my leases are covered for people to gain access to addresses if my main server goes down, and that's it. So, nice little thing. Don't have to worry about split scopes. Works out great to be able to get things going. And that's basically about it, man, for DHCP failover.
Awesome.
Let's flip back to some slides and see where we're up to next.
Yeah. I'm still thinking you should skip the IPEM. You should go straight to NAP. Because you know what's going to happen.
I need a NAP right now.
He's going to go IPAM until we are 10 minutes past.
I'm going to try.
And then there'll be no NAP. And I want to
have
my NAP. So.
Look at this one right here, IP address management. I actually did this session in gory detail at TechEd Australia and TechEd New Zealand because there's so much interest in IP address management. It was actually a packed house because people are dealing with this issue right now of how do you manage your IP addresses, how do you manage which range of addresses you assign your servers, how do you manage which range of addresses you assign your workstations, your wireless clients, that sort of stuff. Typically in the past it's been done by crypt notes, scratchet notes.
You give the 100s to this, the 200s to
that. I would
that,
normally reserve 20 addresses for nothing at the very beginning in case you need to have hardware stuff. I then do from 20 to 50 would be my servers, and then 50 to 150 would be my clients, and then 150 to whatever would be another wireless client set up. So that was all...
That doesn't work?
Right up inside the steel vault up there, dude. Right. And the steel vault sometimes can go a little bit blank for remembering.
It's covering the metal
plate.
The hat
holds all the gray matter in it, right? Okay. So the other thing that you could do is you could obviously use spreadsheets, you could share them amongst your people, your other administrators, but generally if the administrator got hit by a bus that designed the IP addressing scheme and it came time to deploy a new rack of servers or a new bunch of workstations, you're out of luck. You got to figure that out all over again.
Yep.
IPAM solves that problem. So IPAM...
But you have it all documented.
Oh, sure you do.
Yeah.
Because as soon as you hit save on that spreadsheet, it's already out of date because some other junior admin hard-coded an IP address for a printer or something like that, right?
Of course.
IP address management assists following of planning out your space, so what I call the humanizing of your IP address space, managing your existing addresses, which is the biggest bulk of what it can do, tracking what is going on for any changes that have happened to your IP address space, and auditing. The way it generally works is it's an agentless-based solution, centrally stored on a box that's running the IPAM server feature, because it's a feature, it's not a role. And you go in and you authorize which servers you're going to be looking to control. You can control Microsoft servers that are running 2012 and 2008, 2008 R2. You unfortunately cannot control non-Microsoft systems because it uses Windows Remote Management to be able to query and modify and do stuff to those individual servers, right? The humanizing aspect of it is basically you configure it. I'll show you how to do that in just a minute. You then go in and personalize your space by going beyond simply having your scopes for the way that you break down your IP address space to make what's called IP address blocks. And an IP address block is literally just my human interpretation of what this range of addresses should be called, building 2, building 7. And I can put additional metadata with those individual scopes and addresses by adding different database attributes into it.
So I find it interesting how you always refer to it as humanizing it when we're almost essentially dehumanizing it. You have to humanize it so that it can dehumanize and take it out of the steel vault.
Good point. So the biggest chunk of what it does is it allows you to take all your information, organize it the way you make sense of it, and then the next cool thing you can do is manage it. I'm not going to have the time to show you how to manage it. I'm going to show you how to set this guy up. But managing-wise, I mean, picture this. You get a request to, say, deploy a IP-based printer over in Building 26, let's say, and it's going to be there for a work period of 4 months starting next Tuesday. You can literally go in and say, right-mouse-click, find me an available address inside this block, which is a subset of a scope, let's say, or a statically managed address range for my printers. It's going to go off and do pings and do DNS queries to say if that's available. It's going to tell me, yep, that's available. You're good to go. No one's registered this IP address before. It then goes in and allows you to fill out a form that sounds like it's going to take more time, but in the long run, it doesn't. Here's the printer. Here's the MAC address. Here's the description. Here's who owns that printer. Here's the asset tag information. Here's the building it belongs to. Here's the host name I want to register in DNS. Here is the reservation name I want to register in DHCP. And I want to make this registration work from next Tuesday until a month from next Tuesday. You fill that information into a single form. You hit OK. It puts the entry in the database. You now have a record of who did it, when they did it, and where they did it from. Next, you go in and right mouse click on that particular record, and you say, make my DNS reservation or entry, make my DHCP reservation. And it goes in using PowerShell and remotely manages the DHCP server to make the reservation and then sets a reminder for you in 1 month minus a week time to basically say, hey, this address is going to expire. Do you still need it? And it's also going to go in and basically say, go ahead and register the computer name inside DNS so it can be found. Yeah, you complete and total IP address management. Beautiful, beautiful stuff. takes some time to get used to and understand it, and it may seem like a slower process, but in the long run, it's now out of your head and onto a relational database.
That's a little bit extra up front for a lot of savings.
Generally,
down
should
the
be.
Road.
You got it, man. The architecture, as I mentioned, is it works with four main modules. Basically, the discovery module, which you have to configure, and then you have access rights according to that. You then manage IP address spaces. You then go in and manage multiple servers. Even better, now you have access to all your DNS servers or all your DHCP servers. Picture the urgent need to go in and, for instance, replace a DNS server, and you need to give it a new IP address. You can actually search across every single one of your DHCP server scopes and do a search, find, and replace for a particular IP address or computer name, FQDN computer name for the DNS server, and replace it with the new one, and it will automatically go out and touch every single one of those scopes and not overwrite, but actually search and replace with the proper one, because you have it inside a local database and it can go off and query stuff. Awesome stuff what you can do. And then lastly, auditing-wise, you can go off and audit stuff and be able to find out who's logging on, because it collects login information, Kerberos ticket generation for when someone logs on, to be able to see what IP address they're using. You could even go down to the level, if you wanted to, of writing custom filters, if you're that crazy, to be able to say who logged on to this IP address and what was their username, and then even what device were they using to log on with. Because you can narrow down the MAC address to be able to find out who the manufacturer of that address happens to be and say maybe it's an iPad, maybe it's an Android tablet, maybe it's a Microsoft Surface tablet or whatever it happens to be.
Wouldn't be an iPad.
Never know. It could be anything. There's so many devices these days, right? So you can actually use all this rich information that's gathered from all those logs and all the stuff that's regularly just kind of obscured and stuck inside their individual programs, bring it to one centralized point, and then I have access to it.
You know, I'm just curious. Is it just me?
Or am I a little passionate about IP?
Well, no. It's not just your passion, but I heard this ringing from just around a good thousand or so faint, you know, kind of, yay! What's going on out there? As I'm looking at the Q&A, I think. I saw 1,000 of them come through there as well. Yay!
Okay, so very easy to set up. I'm going to show you how to set this up right now. And I think let's talk about requirements first. So yes, we're going to show you how to set it up and then how to configure it. How to set it up and how to do discovery. We don't have time to go into the semantics of how to use it. The good thing is you can set this up purely from discovery mode and basically not impact any of your live workings of DHCP and DNS. The cool thing I haven't talked about just yet is it also is delegatable out to other people. So you could actually give this to your junior admins. Mm-hmm. To be able to manage address space. And the only way they can manage address space is to use the IPAM console if you wanted to. You can give it to your auditors for security to be able to find out who's surfing the web with their particular types of devices they're not supposed to be using, stuff like that. So requirements. Has to belong to a domain. Use domain authentication. IPAM should not and cannot be a domain controller. It actually is blocked in the install process. IPv6 has to be enabled if you want to manage IPv6. By default, it's only going to be managed in IPv4. If you have IPv6 installed, you have the option to go off.
But just to clarify, you don't need IPv6 to use IPAM.
Correct.
You only need it if you're using IPv6.
Right, to be able to manage it. You have to log on with a domain account to be able to authenticate against the local groups to find out if you have rights to do stuff, because you can delegate out. And then logging of account logon events has to be enabled for IP address tracking to be able to do it. So let's go off and actually start with the install.
Let's get into that demo.
Yeah, no, look, it's the next slide. The demo's there. We're
all
getting
right,
there, right?
Go.
We're getting there.
Let's do it.
Jeez, what is this instant gratification of people?
Still want him to get to the demo so I can
have
my
nap. While I'm getting ready for the demo, you got any questions specifically?
No, they want the demo. That's,
okay, they just
that's the
see
questions.
It.
Get
I
to the demo.
A darn demo, eh?
Yes.
Okay, server one. So again, this is not a domain controller. This is simply server one. I do not have IPAM installed, so very obviously the very first step is I got to go into manage Adremo features, and then let's go up here and say bring it on. It's a role-based feature, and I want to bring it in.
Those are roles.
It is a feature. IP address management server. Install it. It says here's all the stuff I'm going to bring in. So .NET framework is going to be used. Remote administration tools to manage DNS. I know it's getting there. I'm just showing all the stuff that's there. IPAM client management, and then off and going. So you're all good. Now, once you have this installed, you also could go in. There's no restart required. Once this is installed, I could actually go in and run this utility completely from a Windows Server 8 machine with RSAT tools installed. So I don't have to log on to the server to get this if I don't want to. And this is where I have to come up with some witty jokes as I'm waiting for the Berbers.
I don't know that we ever need to go to the server. We can everything can be done with the Windows 8 our stat tools.
Absolutely. I'm struggling to find something that you have to actually log on the console.
I don't know how. I mean, what can't you do through Server Manager, and you can get that through the RSAT tools on Windows 8?
I'm thinking.
Don't hurt yourself.
I know. I don't think so. I think it's all good.
You know, I will tell you, while you're thinking and while we're waiting for the bar, I didn't get a chance to actually read. I didn't click on the link and read, but I believe there was an answer that I saw floating around a couple times on the on that XP or DNS with XP clients. So if you were looking for the answer to that, scroll through, look at some of the answers that were out there. There was a link that was put out there with a good, I believe it was a TechNet article or discussion, actually, on using XP with DNSSEC.
And you should also probably look at possibly migrating off of XP and moving to, like, Windows 7 or Windows 8, but, you know, it's another...
Well, that's why I tried saying earlier, and you were all, I'm not going to say that answer.
So we'll go there. Okay, so he's now installed. Okay. Now the node is available and listed here as the IPAM node. And again, if I simply added this server to my all servers list from my workstation, I'd be able to see it too. It's currently connected up to an IPAM server. It's simply showing you, yes, I'm connected to this guy here because that's where IPAM happens to be. Next step is I want to go off and provision the IPAM server. And again, if you haven't had a chance to as of yet, these are all context-sensitive reading documents you can go off and take a look at, TechNet articles, great sort of stuff. So let's go off and provision my IPAM server. Bring it up. Kicks off a wizard basically saying, here's what it does to manage DHCP, DNS, network policy servers, and the like. Hit next. How do I want to do this provisioning? Now, the reason why it comes up with this, picture the ability to go off and to do a dynamic discovery of all my DNS systems, all my DHCP systems, all my domain controllers. Would I want this one install to take control of everything or not? If it's a smaller environment and I'm not worried about scalability, so I'm talking about somewhere around 150 to 200 DHCP servers, that's around the time limit where you want to go kind of at your max, you'd look at saying, you know what, we need to figure out a better way to delegate this out, to have multiple IPAM servers that are out there. I'm going to say use group policy based. So what this means is, instead of me having to worry about configuring manual network shares, manual security groups, firewall rules manual in each server, let group policy do it all. Mm-hmm. So it's going to go off and do group policy for me. And send me what is the prefix name it's going to use, IPAM.
You know, just to clarify, all these different servers that it's going to go out there, these are just Microsoft servers?
These are only Microsoft servers, 2008 R2 with the management framework installed on it, and 2008 as well as Server 2012.
Okay.
When it goes off and does
that question is coming through a number of times.
It's going to be querying DNS, among other things, to be able to find them. This does not work with discovery of non-Microsoft systems. I can talk about importing and exporting data from non-Microsoft systems.
Right.
That's another topic.
But it's a little bit more manual than you have to tell it.
You got it. So I want to just make a reference here, just so you guys know. It is going to go in and basically tell you you need to make these GPOs with all the appropriate settings to make it easier for you. They actually create a PowerShell commandlet that does it. Mm-hmm. So I'm choosing this method, and it's simply warning me I have to run the invoke IPAM GPO provisioning PowerShell commandlet to be able to get this to work. Hit apply, provisions the system, and basically goes off and gets happy with that for being able to run for provisioning. I'm running out of nap time, my friend.
Yeah, and I'm a little upset about that.
There we go.
It's my favorite part of the day.
Waiting for completion. Come on, provision it. There we go. So, successfully went ahead. The settings are applied to the managed objects. They're ready to go. Security groups have been created. The database has been created. And the access to IPAM tasks are now ready to go. I hit OK. Next, I got to go up and simply say, go off and do server discovery. So basically, where am I going to look for my systems? I want to add my domain. So basically, you can filter the domain. I'm going to look for DNS servers, DHCP, and domain controllers. It's warning me again about this invoke IPAM GPO provisioning system. Hit OK. Domain selected. Start my server discovery. It's going to go off and start my discovery process.
You got to love how they give you the steps.
I mean, I know. It's big, bright bullets to say, here you go. And just to be able to help you guys out on this guy here, I'm going to go ahead and get this GPO ready, which is, here are the GPOs that were created, information-wise. I need to go off and run that commandlet that I need to run. And if I just go back up here, it'll tell me when I need to run it for the configuration. Come on, what did I find? It's currently running the discovery task. Okay, remember this guy. Invoke IPAM provisioning. So let's go ahead and get this ready here. So invoke IPAM GPO provisioning on the IPAM server. And command line switches. I don't have autocomplete in here turned on because I'm not using ISE. So let's actually go in here and just quickly do a get help just to make sure I got the right command, because I like to use get help. And it says, you want to download the things. Don't worry about downloading the latest ones because they're all good. So I say invoke IPAM provisioning, the domain I'm going to be using this for. So let's go in here and say invoke IPAM provisioning. I'm going to say dash domain is, no, it's not Contoso, adatum.com. The prefix name, GPO prefix name. Is it prefix or prefix? IPAM.
What country are you from?
And then the IPAM server configuration name, which is IPAM server FQDN. And this is lonsvr1.adatum.com. And then I'm not going to bother identifying delegated GPO user, delegated GPO group, and then domain controller strings and pass through and stuff like that, because it's going to take the defaults for what they all are. And just to be certain, I'm going to say, what if? And it's going to come down and say, hey, let me make this a bit larger so you guys can see this with a properties change for my font to make it a bit easier to see. Maybe this much. Okay. Okay, that's too much. Come in there. There we go. So it's saying, here's the parameter. It's going to run it. It's going to go off and have access to stuff. And basically, that's GPOs. You do not have the specified operation parameters of delegate user, delegated group. The delegation parameters can be set later on if you wanted to, but basically, you're all set to go. So very simply, take out my what if, and then that guy there now is going to be run. Continue that and run it, and it goes off and runs it. Creating the GPOs, importing the GPOs from the file structure that it created, and then goes off and talks to it, and then now done.
Now after it creates them and links them and all that fun stuff that it just did, do you need to run a GP update?
I should be doing a GP update, but not until I go in and say start server discover. Oh, sorry, server discovery's already started. I want to say select or add server. So basically, if I go back over here to my server inventory, take a look at this. It found that there was one machine, London DC1, that should be managed. Mm-hmm. I actually have to go in here and edit this server and then say, yes, I want to manage this box. And then it comes back as saying blocked, but it's ready to go. On this box, I would now want to go in and run GP update, DC1, because all I've done by identifying my discovery of servers and say manage this guy is I've now updated the ACL filter on those GPOs to say allow this guy to be applied, mm-hmm. and he now becomes managed. So there is a time delay for this to happen. That's also a reason why I can't show you how it goes beyond that. But basically, if I wanted to try, but I got 7 minutes left, we'll see if I can just run this guy and have him come back to it. Basically, GP update force. And off it goes to be able to do it. So we'll see if he comes back, but I don't want to wait because I want to get back to the NAP part. That's IPAM, setting it up. That's actually part of the most difficult part, which is getting the time sync for having your GPOs updated, the ACLs updated to them, and then the settings that are on them as well. So that brings us to NAP time. What is up for network access protection? Network access protection is the exact same concept of what you could do in the past of being able to set up a certificate of health, if you will, for who, Ed. NAP is Network Access Protection. Dude, Ed, buddy, I need you to still work with the questions, dude, okay?
You said it was NAP time.
It's not NAP time.
Okay.
It's NAP time for Network Access Protection time. Network Access Protection basically enforces your health requirements. Have you been patched recently? Have you done updates? Have you gotten your security health done? Do you have the appropriate firewall scans done, firewall rules in place? Do you have the appropriate antivirus scans that are taking place, stuff like that? That's all in there, and it can offer remediation. It is essentially the exact same as it was as 2002. The difference is now it is a role under RRAS, and also now supported by PowerShell. Only difference. So really, there's no sense in really talking that much more about MAP. Architecturally, you literally have this lovely eye chart of a diagram that has...
Let's give everybody 60 seconds to absorb stare what this at this says. And understand it all.
With the concept of NAP servers, you have a health server and a policy server that you define your policy for what is a healthy, what is an unhealthy system. A client connects into it, has to be checked against this network health policy server to say, hey, do you meet these criteria? If not, you go into this no-no area. That no-no area could be an IPsec segregated group. It could be simply a network VLAN. It could be simply a subnet. It could be the lightest form, which is a DHCP subnet that is fake, if you will, and kind of a little bubble that doesn't really exist. And then you can talk to remediation servers to get yourself healthy again. Really cool concept for how it works. It also can work in conjunction with other industry implementers that have done network access control, or NAC, as opposed to NAP.
Very practical.
I think they made sure that their engineers didn't fall asleep, so they renamed it from NAP to NAC. Scenarios, awesome for roaming laptops. Definitely if they've been at home for a while, they come back into the environments. I've actually helped out implement this at a major university up in Canada where I've been from to basically get this working for all their guest VPN access and guest IP address access, that sort of stuff. Desktop computers, visiting laptops, that sort of stuff. Considerations are basically group policy is your friend. That deploys your client settings. Plan your enforcement. You want a type to enforce. The easiest is DHCP. The most complex, if you don't have it set up, is IPsec. And then have the ability to have a remediation network. If you're blocking someone because they don't have update patches, give them the ability to get the update
Give them the update patches.
If they don't have the ability to do a virus scan because their signature's out of date, get them a place to get their virus signature up to date, that sort of stuff. And then also make sure that you provide administrative support for the solution. So they need to have a hot a phone number they can call or an email they can call if they don't understand how to update their machines. Requirements to enforce this, basically, has to have a NAP agent to run. The policy server has to be set up and running on server 2012. The health certificates basically are required as rules to determine what's being evaluated on the client side of things. The health policies determine the criteria that's being selected. Certificates are basically validated on login or can be reissued and revalidated again. And they require authentication. And then finally, remediation networks are basically the fastest way for clients to get fixed. And then the different modes of NAP, you can basically isolate them in VPN, like a quarantine, if you will, if you wanted to. Very simple concept. You can go in with IPsec requirements, where you have to have a certificate authority involved, and basically you lock them away from different servers they can't get to until they actually have passed their health certificate, if you wanted to. They also have the simplest form, which is DHCP-based as well, to be able to simply put them into this little pocket. The problem with DHCP-based is it's the least amount of security because someone could easily statically assign themselves an address and still work. And that basically brings us up to the end of the networking session. A couple of minutes left. We will take some Q&A if you're interested.
Did we want to see the end of what you were in the middle of? Or?
I don't know
if we had enough time to get
check your questions
there.
While I get this guy ready here. And I'll take a look to see if my London server is happy with my GP update. Where is it? It was server one I did this on, right? Wasn't it? Still hasn't come through on an update as of yet for being able to do it. So I'm just going to go ahead and do another GP update that force and see where he comes from. But again, take some time to get set up. Great sessions. Again, if you want some additional content on NAP or additional content on IPAM, a little biased because I presented sessions, channel 9 at msdn.com/events, and then you can go off and take a look at tech ed events and look for previous years and sessions. There was a session in North America, Australia, New Zealand. Very, very cool stuff.
Cool. I think that's about all we have.
I think, you know what? I need some recharge time, man. Next up is direct access,
yes.
Which is kind of an extension of what you can do with remote access stuff. So let's take a breather, come back in a short break, and back at the top of the hour for being able to do the next module on direct access.
Access.
You got it. We'll be back.